Welcome, everyone, to the Our Strange Skies podcast. I'm your host, Rob Christofferson, and I'm joined today by Sam and Sage from Your Brain on Weird. How y'all doing today? It's a lovely Thursday. How y'all doing?
Great.
Great.
How are you?
Fantastic. Like, that is apt for this Thursday. Did not know what it wanted to be. It was rainy, it was sunny, and it kept going back and forth, and I hated it. I hated everything about it, and it's gonna be really cold tomorrow, which is, you know, the sign that winter is right around the corner. So, you know, it's a Thursday in fall. Yep.
Yep. Happy equinox, by the way.
Happy equinox. Yeah, it's Maybon.
Yeah. It is. Hey. That is very true. Very true.
It's time
true.
For it to be cold again. I wasn't quite ready, but I think I've had a couple of days of cold and wearing like comfy hoodies, and now I'm like, okay, I'm ready to be comfy again.
Yep. Do not sweat profusely just from walking. Yes, absolutely.
That'd be nice.
It would be really nice. Today, we're going to a place that I think has a reputation for being, you know, chilly kind of most of the time anyway, which is Northern Wales. We're talking about the Sunderland family. And I've talked a little bit about the Sunderland family before. I featured part of their story in episode 96, but this story progressed beyond the original articles that I found about them into we're like saving the world from, like, you know, planets that are coming into our own time and space and like just going to ruin everything. We're talking about psychic questing today, which is a topic that I never knew about until I dove into this story. This is a story that goes all over the place. So first and foremost, I want your reactions when I sent you this outline. What did you think first and foremost?
It was a lot. Like, I felt like there is just like a everything, like a little bit of everything.
Yeah, no, I agree. There's like a little bit of like haunting type stuff. There's like abduction. There's the psychic questing thing, which is like a whole separate issue.
Mm-hmm. Yes. This story literally has it all and the kitchen sink, folks. I'm not understating that when I say this. Like, this, it's a contactee kind of story that is very unique, very different than what you're probably used to hearing with most kind of abduction stories, with, you know, kind of like a singular type of phenomenon that manifests itself in like very similar ways in these abduction like events, with like a few stray kind of like incidences where people are like, oh yeah, I had a strange interaction with this really weird human looking dude, like walking home or something like that. Like, this story, there's weird looking people, but like we get to know them a little bit, which is great. We never normally get to know them at all.
I want to be their friend. They're just like me.
Yes.
Weird looking people.
They're just weird looking people, folks. And to be honest, you missed the massive belch at the beginning of this episode. So, like,
edit it back in.
Yeah, yeah, right. That's the bonus audio. Like, that y'all deserve the bonus audio. But we're gonna go over a little bit again the kind of beginning of this story, which we did cover on episode 96, and it starts in, kind of in March of 1978. publicity for Close Encounters of the Third Kind is really like it's ratcheting up. It's premiering in Wales a year after it came out in the States. And there were newspaper advertisements all over the place in Wales newspapers. And on one particular night, Marion Sunderland's son, his name's Darren, he was about 10 years old in 1978, asked her what a close encounter of the third kind was. And when she told him, he quietly announced to the family that he had had one of these a couple of years ago in the summer of 1976. It's just a casual thing, you know?
Oh, that's happened to me. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's a tale as old as time. It just casually comes up in conversation. You just happen to have a close encounter of the third kind when you were 8 years old. Totally understand.
Casual. Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely casual. So he tells the family this, and his sister, his name is Gaynor. She's 11 years old. She was outside. She comes inside and she makes fun of him for this story. And, you know, just saying he's inventing things, you know, brothers and sisters making fun of each other. But we're told that it's kind of uncharacteristic for her because, you know, she's very supportive of her brother. She's very loving. So, you know, when she comes inside later on, she approaches her mother. And she nervously relays the encounter that she had with a UFO and its occupant. She had one, too. Again, it's just casual. It happens.
Okay. And she's just sitting there like, what is with my children?
Yeah. Like, as a parent, how do you handle that? Like, are you thinking, do I need to take them to therapy? Because I don't know what this is. What is going on?
I would hope so. I mean, even if, you know, if you do believe that it happened, then you would think that it probably, you know, had some kind of psychological effect on them. So, you know, they should probably be going to therapy anyway, even if it did happen. If you don't think it happened, then yeah, your first thought is probably my kid needs therapy. I would hope.
that's a fair reaction. I totally back that up. But yeah, like so we get their stories, and we start with Darren's. And according to Darren, in July of 76, he was walking down a road called Codon Road, and he's passing by this field, and in this field he sees this kind of glinting object. It kind of catches him in the periphery, and in this field he sees this object on four tall legs. It's elongated, and that when you first look at the sketch, it kind of looks like it's ripped from the Jetsons, because it's kind of like that domed kind of craft. It's transparent and it's kind of flat on the bottom, and it has feet when it lands and stuff like that. It definitely reminds me of like a Jetsons kind of space age vehicle in a way. And it's got this like elongated tailpiece, kind of similar to the way that airplanes have. And atop this flattened section, you know, there's this large dome, and it's made up of like kind of small squares in a way. And at the top of the dome is what he says is a periscope. So this is definitely ripped from the mind of a child. Like, there's no way around this. This is something a child definitely invented in their mind.
Yeah, it had the legs, and it was long out the top, but the top was made out of a bunch of squares, but mm-hmm. It was circle. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
A kid. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. This is definitely from the mind of the kid. And on the side closest to him, he can make out these kind of black symbols that resemble kind of like, there's a bunch of different ones, but one that he points out is like a circle with kind of a cross in it, kind of similar to if you take kind of like a watch battery. And you look at it and you look on top, you'll see that it has a like a cross on the top of it. Kind of look similar to that in a way. But there's these series of wires extending from the back end of this thing, and they're attached to these blue bulbs that were on top of poles, and they were just kind of pushed into the ground a little bit. But the most alarming thing here is that there's a series of five or six men that appear to be kind of like struggling to walk a little bit. They were carrying what he describes as guns. And the sketch of these beings is like the most unhinged thing that you've ever seen, because it looks like a guy on his last nerve and he's about to murder somebody. Like, that's the best way to, like, it's very cartoonish in a way. It's like a very cartoony looking dude with kind of like short, kind of like Homer Simpson hair, but with a little bit more, you know, just like very sparse hair on top. And they're on their last nerve and they're looking down at these bulbs and they keep pressing on these guns that they have in their hands, like they're trying to do something with them. But whatever they're doing, it just wasn't working. And according to the report, quote, they were jumping up and down apparently with rage. So just full of rage. Like,
wow. That's going to be us this weekend, Sam. We're going to a metal concert this weekend. That's going to be us.
You will be jumping up and down with rage. You will be exactly. You'll be these aliens. Absolutely.
I'm going to channel them. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So these men were damn short. They were about 4 foot 10 inches tall, very human in appearance, despite having like angular bodies is the way that they describe them. Just like a few wisps of hair atop the head. And they wore these kind of like silver tops and green pants, which, you know, the fashion choices here. I'm picturing kind of like a Peter Griffin in a way, you know, just kind of very similar to that.
Now my first thought is the aliens, one of their first exposures to our culture was Family Guy. And they're like, okay, well, now we have to dress like this guy so that they aren't scared by us.
Yes, great. They are time travelers. They saw this stuff. They came back and they're like, we got a Peter Griffin this thing. Like, that's our role model here. It's just got to happen. But
interesting choice, but okay.
Yes, interesting choice. Here's what I'm going to do, because I need to find the sketches of these things for you, because it's just absolutely just bonkers hilarious. You're going to look for, this is a PDF, so I'm putting it in the chat here now. You're going to want page 15.
14. Oh, boy.
So can you describe for me what you're seeing right in front of you right now? It's the sketch of this individual.
I think you were pretty spot on when you said Homer Simpson, but with more hair.
Yeah.
It literally, he's got like four pieces of hair and just like, I don't know, dumb face, square face.
But he's like wearing headphones, you know?
He's like got headphones. Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
He definitely looks like he's angry.
Yes. Definitely looks like he is. Like, have you ever seen that one video clip? It's supposed to be, it's like one of the worst like movies ever, and it's like an image of a guy and he moves a garbage can, and there's a guy holding a gun and he's like, garbage day, and like he shoots him.
Yes.
And it looks like the epitome of that right there. That's the first thing that kind of comes to mind. Yeah.
I've never heard of that, but
it's absolutely fantastic. It's like one of the best worst scenes in any film ever, but
you'll have to find it later. You would enjoy it. It's very good.
Okay.
Yes. But as you can see, excellent fashion choices here, but you know, these guys are frustrated. One of these men walks up to the bulbs that are in the ground and he starts hitting it with the butt of the gun, and he destroys all of them but one. And before long, this kind of central ramp comes down from the bottom of the ship. And suddenly, a creature, which he describes as not unlike a dinosaur, with a green body and a red neck, come down the ramp, and in place of ears, it has long, floppy cheeks. And that is the creature that you're seeing right next to that man coming down. It is a weird looking bird. It looks like a weird looking bird.
It looks like a bird. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
So you're saying that's the ears then?
Yes. That wavy, huge wavy line, big floppy ears. Like, this is a, yeah.
Okay. So did Darren draw these himself? Or did someone else draw these from his description? Do you know?
I think that he drew these, if I'm remembering correctly. It doesn't mention in there, but I'm pretty sure he did, because with Gaynor's sketches, I think are adapted from sketches that they drew. So somebody basically took their sketches and did their kind of own interpretation of them. So,
okay.
But, you know, got that George Jetson-y looking craft right there. Just absolutely brilliant. So this creature comes down the ramp with these big, huge, floppy cheeks. And one of the men ended up growling at this bird, and it turned around with a sad expression and walked back up the ramp. Just upsetting bird. Aww. Dinosaurs here. Yeah, right?
They're like, who let you out? Get back inside.
Yep. Okay.
So big floppy.
Yeah, those big floppy. It's just like, you want to go pinch them. It's what you want to do. And, you know, I do at this point, because, you know, poor dinosaur bird goes back up inside. And then there's this human man with a pink face, larger quantity of hair, like more significant amount of hair. And he appears on the inside of the dome. He can kind of see through it and sees this this man in the dome. He sees kind of the control panel. But it's like a picture that's projected on a wall, basically. And eventually this man creepily turns towards Darren and he just smiles at him. No, thank you.
No thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. And one other fun feature is that when these shorter, angrier men entered their craft, they would shrink down once they got inside. So they were, in fact, really tiny inside their craft, which is, you know, a feature if you want to, you know, save on headroom and everything, you know, make a little more room.
Cool. Yeah, that's smart.
Yeah, it is. And then eventually, you know, Darren just like, you know, beats feet out of there and gets runs home. But interestingly enough, with Gaynor's story, hers happens in a very similar way, with kind of similar looking beings, kind of less angry looking, though there's an angry expression in here, you know, here to there. But, you know, Gaynor, she was riding her bike on a different section of Codon Road. Apparently there's like kind of like a lot of fields. It's a very rural area. There isn't a lot of houses out there. There's a few. They have a few neighbors, but at one point she's descending a hill and she's noticing in this empty field this kind of silvery cigar. It's about 35 feet long, 10 feet high, has rectangular windows going around the craft, and it's casting this yellow glow from the inside. And she at first thinks that this is for a carnival. Like, there's got to be a carnival coming to town or something like that, which it's an interesting thought, but in rural Clwyd County, maybe not the place where a carnival would be coming. I could be wrong, but Clwyd County did not seem to be the most populous county in Wales. Just do it from a Google search. But you know, she sees it kind of confused, and following that thought, this kind of shadow passes in front of one of the windows. So she drops down and she takes cover in some hedges, and the scene that's about to play out is actually on the cover of that PDF that I sent you. It's going to play out exactly like that, with a creature that looks surprisingly stunned, and it's this is one of my favorite images of all time. It's so fantastic. So she's lying on her stomach and she watches as this man appears from an open door and a ramp that came down from the front of the ship. And he was about 5'5", thin. Again, we got angular features described. And he walked in these kind of jerky sidesteps because if you notice, his knees are a little further up on his leg than you would normally see a human.
Yeah, now that you point that out, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ew, I hate that.
Interesting. Interesting. Okay, go on.
So, you know, making these, you know, jerky movements, has a very large and, you know, and round eyes, like, you know, kind of like the eyes that make you think that someone is screaming all the time, has that look. Yeah. Pink irises, which is, you know, kind of freaky. And they had three fingers and a thumb, so one less digit on the hands. And he's wearing this kind of one-piece silver suit. There's no zipper, no seams, which is kind of your typical alien attire. They've figured out how to put on clothes without the need for zippers, which, you know, break down and stuff. You know, it's frustrating. It's a human frustration.
Yes.
But, yeah, I hate zippers. Me and zippers, just not a fan.
Buttons fan. I can't do buttons personally.
No. terrible inventions. Just kind of they're antiquated at this point. These aliens have figured it out. Okay. When do we step up to the plate, become trendsetters in fashion, and figure out the seamless outfit, the one that, yeah, we are able to get out of it, but we're not giving away our secrets. Where is that in my fashion? I need it.
Sam and I talked a while ago about how we think that the next new fashion trend should just be, you know, almost like tattoos, you know, like little stickers. Mm-hmm. You can just slap them mm-hmm. on yourself, just like adhesive.
Absolutely.
You get up every morning, you know, that. You have a bunch of sheets of stickers in your closet, and you just pick which ones you want and just, you know, mm-hmm. slap them on.
I'm down with that. I'm down.
Seamless. Like,
yes.
It seems like a lot less work than like really putting on a t-shirt. And I stand by that because, like, you know, slapping something on you is a lot different than just like putting a t-shirt on. It's just like, there's so much work involved with that. Like, a lot. It's just,
yep.
We're human beings. How have we not evolved past this? Like, how have we not gotten past this?
Either that or we just do cloth tube.
That's fair. That's fair.
It just goes over your head and you're just like.
Yep. I dig that. I definitely dig that. Because yeah, I think you could, like.
Optional. I would say optional arm holes.
I dig that, though, because, like, one thing that I want to do is just, like, you know, slap tubes with people, like, all over the place. Just, like, you know, turn it into a day where you're just, like, going up to people and just, you know, like, jousting with the tubes. I think it'd be great. I think it would be.
Have you ever seen two giraffes fight?
Yes.
That's what I'm thinking of right now.
That's exactly it. Yep, exactly it. Tubes. Yeah. Speaking of tubes, this dude has a tube of some kind. She describes it as kind of like a gun in a way that Darren did, only like whenever this being pressed the trigger, there would be these wavy red lines that would kind of come down from it. And it moved like incredibly slowly, which is interesting because it's like, is this like the dial up version of a laser gun? I'm not sure. Like, it seems weird to see a slow moving beam of light coming from a gun, but I guess, you know, with this, that's what it was. And it used it to create holes in the ground and placing a hand in each of them. So from the report, quote, Gaynor had now been watching for 10 to 15 minutes and she was uncomfortable and frightened, as any of us would probably be with, I mean, the knees, just the knees, first and foremost. I'm scared. I'm scared of those knees. I'm scared of what I would be like with knees like that on Earth in this gravity. I wasn't made for that gravity, if that's the case. But she kind of moves her leg slightly and she got it caught on a hedge. So she made a little bit of a noise. And unfortunately, at this point, the entity was only about 10 feet away from her. So I'm pretty sure that's what we're seeing on the cover of this issue of Flying Saucer Review, is the creature's like, oh God, it's there. It's there and it's staring at me.
That's terrifying. That's so terrifying.
Yeah. He did not turn his body, which was, you know, sideways to her. He moved his eyes towards her, though, which is, yeah.
Worse.
That's worse.
Yeah. And when he looked at her, she started to feel dizzy and cold. And she said she felt like this being was like entering her mind, you know, through telepathy and just kind of assessing the threat level of this child and, you know, realizing, you know, it's no big deal. She, however, is like paralyzed on the ground. She can't move. Can't move at all. And this being just goes on, keeps making holes in the ground. Like, nothing's wrong. Nothing's going on. No, child saw me. I've got work to do. Hole. Why is this gun so slow? Hole.
I can hear, know. I can hear that. For some reason, I'm thinking of that weird wobbly noise that you hear in like sci-fi movies, you know, where they shoot, it's like, whoa, 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 or something. Yes. That's what I'm hearing in my head right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like this guy, we will get his name later, but just like, ooh. Dear God, why have we not got better equipment yet? This is horseshit. Need to talk to HR or somebody about this, because I am done. I am done with this.
They spent all the money on the outfit.
Yeah, clearly. Clearly. I can't imagine that stuff's cheap. It just can't be. But Gaynor also heard what she described as kind of a whimpering sound coming from inside the object, which she, you know, suggests that somebody else is in there. So she sees the
weird dinosaur bird thing.
No, we have no weird dinosaur birds this time. Instead, we have a hand that comes out and it waves up and down. And in response to the man on the ground, he moved kind of from side to side as if to acknowledge the hand in a way. And then he walked into the craft where she heard this kind of murmur that was going on. And he did kind of emerge later, disappeared behind the ship. And another figure actually ended up emerging. And this, she could distinctly tell, was a woman. Had the figure of a woman. And she was kind of slightly shorter. And instead of I think she did have a gun, but she also had this kind of like jagged knife with her too, which is also creepy. Very, very weird looking. Not a fan of that at all.
It's pretty cool. I like it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe not when it's pointed at me, but in general, it's pretty sick looking knife.
Absolutely. So this woman, She comes over and she looks at Gaynor. And again, she feels this dizzying cold feeling. And according to her, she'd been lying there for about 30 minutes or so when another whimpering sound came from the inside of the craft. Not as sure exactly what's causing that whimpering sound, but the woman looks up to the sun. And there's like kind of this famous image that appeared in newspapers of this figure kind of hunched over and looking at Gaynor. And she kind of has this like, kind of an angry look on her face a little bit, not like the deranged Homer Simpson looking things wearing the Peter Griffin outfits, but like just kind of like if I could think of it like you know that the Muppet that is the blue eagle that has that, like, he's got the unibrow going on, just kind of looks dapper. That's the kind of look that she had on her face at the time, which is, it's very apt. Like, just like, oh God, I don't want to be here. Like, get me out of here. So.
Oh, okay. I had to Google it.
Yeah. Just now like,
I understand.
Yeah. That kind of stern expression of, I'm here. I don't want to be here. I need to get on with my day, I guess. But she enters the craft, and whatever was holding Gaynor there, she's finally able to get up, and she first runs, forgets her bike, goes back for her bike, and then she takes off with it. She doesn't ride her bike. She's running with her bike, and she's just kind of fearful that this UFO is going to pursue her, but she kind of hears a faint humming sound at her back. And she turned around and she smelled it. There was a smell of like something burning, and this object shoots up and away. And she, you know, pedals back home. And for confirmation, she returned to the field the next day, found an oval patch of grass where the craft sat on the ground. And the grass was kind of flecked with silver. And the holes were no longer there, strangely. The grass itself kind of looked a little greener, as if, you know, rain had come. But after they both, Darren and Gaynor, tell their stories to their mother in 1978, about around August, there's a small story that appears in the Liverpool Daily Post and Echo. And it's kind of unclear because the Jenny Randalls and Paul Wetnall, who are the main investigators on this case, they wrote a book in the early 1980s called Alien Contact about this story. And nobody knows how it got to press. But the problem is that the only people that know this story are Gaynor, Darren, and her parents, and probably the rest of the family. So who did they tell? You know, you tend to wonder, but a couple of days after the story's in the paper, Marion, she steps outside. She's enjoying the evening air. She often takes the dog out for late night walks and stuff, but she's looking to kind of lights to a nearby city. And there is kind of one that stands out. It looks larger than the others. It's pale yellow, and there's kind of like bright whites and reds and oranges kind of mixed with it. And she calls to her husband, Fred, and, you know, he quickly dismisses it as an airplane, you know, typical kind of, I think, husband response in most of these cases, where like the husband's kind of like, nah, I don't know, I didn't see anything. But, you know, could be
crazy
anything.
Woman.
Yeah, exactly. That seems to be what it is most of the time. Yeah. In these stories, just like dudes being that way. And, you know, Marion kind of believed it. Was like, yeah, it's probably a plane, even though there's no reason why a plane would be that low in the sky. There's no place for a plane over there to land. Doesn't make much sense. But, you know, it's the only rational thing that you can hold on to at the time. That was until the object just split in two, which, ooh, you know, yeah, planes don't do that. Have you ever seen a plane do that?
No,
I don't think that's supposed to happen. Yeah, that's, I don't think, yeah.
feel like you're gonna have a problem if your plane just splits in two.
Yeah,
I don't know.
You might.
It's not a good thing. It's not a good thing at all. And this thing splits into two smaller yellow lights, and they kind of move around a bit before they merge back together. And the object just kind of slowly merges with the ground, which is weird. But yeah, it shouldn't do that. So, you know, there's a lot of weird stuff happening in Northern Wales. The year before, 1977, West Wales has this kind of huge flap going on where, you know, the Broadhaven school landing is kind of like the biggest case from that time. People are seeing UFOs, and they're seeing what they dubbed these tall spacemen. They're over like 7 feet tall, and they're kind of like floating around people's properties. They appear at in one family's farm, and then another woman's house, and there's a motel where they're seen and stuff. There's a lot of weird stuff happening in Wales around this time. So things just keep happening. They continue to kind of see lights off and on in the area and such. But in October of 1978, Gaynor, Carl, who was her older brother, and Marion would see kind of like very similar objects on the same day. So Gaynor and Carl, they had gone to like a disco, and as they were returning, they noticed these kind of like what they think are fireworks in the distance, kind of near Guy Fawkes Day. And, you know, examining them closer through, you know, these objects appeared to be kind of dancing on hedgerows. So they're smaller, they're animate, they're doing whatever, you know, they feel like doing, just being kind of weird. And they see them kind of briefly shoot away. So about an hour after they see that, Marion steps outside with the dog, taking the dog for an evening walk. And she likes to look at stars with binoculars and stuff. And on this particular night, she spots an unusually bright object in the sky. So it's hovering over the mountains, nearby mountains, and through binoculars, she sees kind of like this white circle. There's kind of an orange hue to it. It kind of reminds her a little bit of the way that a light bulb kind of illuminates and stuff. And she later complains to the military. Military calls her back, and they're interested. They're wondering, like, you know, what is it that you saw, ma'am? And, you know, she's trying to get to the bottom of it. She asks him if there's any planes or anything in the area. And he's like, no, there's no military maneuvers or anything. And then he says, like, there are other odd lights that were reported in the same area at the same time. So, you know, it's confirmed by the military. We got the military in on this. So things are strange. They're very strange. And what we learn about the Sunderland family is that Marion and most of her children have psychic abilities. They were born with them. And for Marion and Carl, these manifestations are kind of a little weaker. But in Gaynor, Darren, and Barry, they seem kind of much stronger. One of the features of it for them is that it manifests into being able to see auras for people. And for Gaynor in particular, she could kind of sense when something was about to happen. She kind of had this precognition type thing when like a phenomenal thing was about to happen, like something to do with the phenomenon. She'd be that creepy kid like, they're here. And I'm like, no. Let's just pump the brakes here for a minute, okay? I don't like
that. No, thank you.
No. You know, lights in the sky were just a very common thing for these folks. And one thing about Gaynor's that she had a very good memory. Like, she had memories of being a toddler, like going back a long time. And she and her brother Darren recalled playing with these lights that would enter their rooms as kids. And they would also see kind of like shadowy figures around the house, which I'm not a fan of. Let's no, thank you. We can not do that. That's cool. It was with the publicity of this case and the subsequent investigation that strange things started to happen around their house as well. They started to notice like these kind of people kind of snooping around their homes, kind of MIB prowler types in a way. Only they were able to jump over hedges, which, you know, just like clear vault over hedges. Very, very weird stuff. And on February 21st, 1979, Gaynor had gone outside one night to play with the neighbor's border collie, whose name was Shep. And once outside, they were playing kind of opposite this little stream. And this dog sits down on its stomach and it's just like looking straight ahead. And in the sky, there's this orange ball of light. And Gaynor looks over into this tall grass because it's kind of a small hilly area with some tall grass. And she sees emerging from them the two beings that she had interacted with 3 years earlier, or almost 3 years earlier. And they were smiling at her, which is a far cry from what they were the last time, which was annoyed as shit. Very annoyed. Just not having it.
Work conditions got better. They did.
Yeah. I'm hoping they got some raises. Good union bennies, a lot of, you know, good things happen for them.
A faster and gun.
That's what I was going to say. A faster hole digging laser. Come on.
Yep.
Like those old slow hole digging lasers are basically the equivalent to the textbook that you had in high school that your parents had before you. Like that's what it was, basically. The hand-me-downs.
The hand-me-down, yeah. Yeah. Now, son, I used this when I was a kid, and now you can use it.
Yes. So, yeah, they're smiling at her. Dig many
holes, my good sir.
Yes. Just, like, dig the hell out of them. Go nuts. It's kind of like, I would imagine giving them that upgrade is like giving a kid a post-hole digger. And watching them go nuts because like I had friends who talked about like there was a guy that I worked with because I worked in a hardware store. I worked at Aubuchon Hardware when I was I was in my early 20s and I there was a coworker and he started talking about like, yeah, I bought a post hole digger. I just went nuts with it, man. I just kept digging holes. What? But it's the power of the post hole digger. You give it to them and they just go nuts. It's like, it's fun.
Yeah. Yeah, don't it is
don't
fun.
Go crazy with power.
Oh, no. You went crazy it. With power.
Absolutely. Yes. So
okay.
Shep's laying there. He's looking at them. He lets out a little whine and they disappear and the light kind of goes out in the sky. And it's also during this month that I don't know who came to this decision. People thought it was a good idea to hypnotically regress children, which I'm going to say is not a good idea. It's never a good idea. Don't hypnotically regress your children, ever. So that happened. Darren was
that's
not
messed up.
Darren was not a good subject for it, and Gaynor didn't really give them anything. So, yeah, just words of the wise. Don't regress your children. That's fucking cruel. As the story progresses, it's March 24th, and Gaynor is babysitting like one of the neighbor's children. And at one point, she calls her mother because she's feeling very kind of uncomfortable. She describes this like kind of feeling that somebody is in the room watching her. So her mother comes over, sits with her. And at one point, she just like jumps up. And she's just like very concerned. But after a while, things kind of calm down and The person she's babysitting for comes home. She goes home the next morning at breakfast. There's this moment where Gaynor just kind of like pops into a trance. And she says, quote, "I think they are important people, leaders or scientists or something like that. They are important to the in the world. They are beautiful to their own kind. They think they are pretty. I don't think all their kind look like that. What they were doing was important to them. Do you understand?" Now, if you're at the breakfast table and your child says this to you, we're going to see a doctor. Like, I yeah. just, yeah, I don't. It that's no. No,
it's the that, do you that, understand that gets me.
Yes. Yes.
Like, no, like, I don't. No.
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 So, like, are the aliens saying this about themselves through her, or is she saying this about them? Like, she's being fed information. I don't know, but like. Still, just a freaky set of words to be saying to anybody. I just no.
Don't like that. It's so much worse when it's a kid too. You know, it's so much creepier. It's like, how do you know mm-hmm. these things?
Right, you're too young to know shit like this. What the hell?
Yeah,
that's what we're dealing with. So by this time, she started dreaming about these beings, and 2 weeks earlier, she'd had a dream in which she was on board a UFO with them. Marion and Gaynor were also seeing strange figures inside the house. So for Marion, they looked kind of like shadow figures. She would see them moving about. But to Gaynor, she was able to see full-bodied type apparitions. And there was one evening she saw a man standing next to the bathroom door, wearing white coverall type clothing that was shimmering. And, you know, they were basically kind of showing how Gaynor's abilities were stronger than her mother's. Like, she just kind of seemed to be the one. And they started talking about something called psigenics, which, you know, is basically just the idea that it could be passed from family member to family member. It's a genetic thing. It's a genetic ability and stuff like that. So not unusual in certain realms of literature, but you know, it is what it is. Jenny Randles and Paul Wetnall, along with local investigators, had been involved with the case throughout 1979. And there was one that suggested if she brought a camera to bed with her, that these dreams would probably stop. And they didn't at all. And on June 24th, Gaynor headed to bed around 8 p.m. She was just reading for a while. She was reading a book called White Boots, which is a book about figure skating. So at around 11 p.m., she starts to feel woozy. And she looked to kind of the... She was laying on her back and she looked up and she can kind of see like the horizon, because in Wales around this period of time, it doesn't get fully dark. You get some elements of daylight. The sun doesn't totally go down, but she can see kind of, you know, outside there's the hinting of sun still in the sky. And she looked up into her ceiling and she sees this big, long, dark tunnel that was emerging into her bedroom. And as Randles and Wetnall wrote in their book Alien Contact, quote, "As if it were a giant vacuum cleaner and she a speck of dust, the helpless child was sucked into the vortex."
Oh my god. Okay.
That's just a banger sentence.
Damn. Yeet.
Child gets yeeted into the fourth dimension, and she emerges in this strange place with green grass. That's the defining feature. There were kind of trees in the distance. There's this kind of flowing stream. You know, I don't know how long it takes to go through the vortex, but seemed to be pretty rather instantaneous. And the two beings stood in front of her. The man was dressed in a one-piece green outfit, similar to kind of, they described it as like an outfit you would see on like a show such as Flash Gordon. And the woman was wearing kind of a light pink dress. And between the man and the woman was a young child, about 2.5 feet tall. And she came to believe that this child was born around the time that she had her encounter in 1976. And what I want to know is, what's the maternity leave like there? Like, you kidding me? She just has a kid. She's back at it. What the frig is this? Like, damn. Give her some time.
I'm telling you, you don't really need maternity leave as long if you get to bring your kid to work with you, you know?
Why would you want to do that? Why would you want
to
do
Teach
that?
Teach them how to dig holes real slow.
Oh, yeah. Here,
the old-fashioned way.
Yeah. Old school way. Child labor. Child labor. Like, it's just what they're doing. So they tell her that she had come from very far away. And the woman introduced herself. Her name was Arna. And the man, his name is Pars. And kind of like, there's an abduction case that we covered, the Carl Higdon abduction. There's a lot of similarities between this particular incident and what Carl Higdon experienced and was shown by the being that he interacted with was called Also One. And they basically show her their city, but they leave their child behind in the process, which is just like bad parenting. It's just
he'll
just
be bad. Fine.
No problem.
We'll leave him here with my gun to dig holes for a few hours.
Yeah, totally gonna be fine. So they kind of touch her hand and the scenery changes immediately. I'm kind of picturing like Ghost of Christmas Past and like kind of like the Muppet Christmas Carol, like kind of that. It's sure. Just, you know, in the blink of an eye, and there's a large red sun. There's like it's bigger than Earth's sun, and it's just hanging in the sky. And there's a familiar blue to the sky. There are buildings with flat roofs and sharp edges. And on one of them, she says she could see a bunch of children playing with a ball. There were no roads, only rough cobbled streets. So I dig that their roads are old school, or they just kind of looked at the roads because they look like they were in disrepair and just basically said, yeah, fuck it. We don't need those. Who cares? Who cares? And they didn't need them because they drove around in hovercrafts. So, you know.
Yeah.
Literally, roads where we're going, yeah. We don't need them. Don't need them anymore.
Yeah. No, they put all the time and effort into researching the actual vehicle instead of researching the road. That's,
you know what? Fair. Good for them. Yep.
Just, they are on it. And they pass by individuals that look similar to Arna and Pars. And, you know, before long, they were back in the field and she was back in her bedroom. And what's interesting is that during the night, Marion had looked in on her children, like she usually did. And she noticed at one point that Gaynor was just like lying on her back, just like flat, looking upward. Looked like she was sleeping. Didn't go in and check on her child. Just assumed, yeah, she's fine. No problem. And, you know, she comes back in a little while later and she sees that she's like under her covers, just like in the normal sleeping position. So, you know, no problem. Just let it go. And when Arna and Pars talked to Gaynor, she said that they come to her in the darkness, which she assumes means her dreams. So that's basically how they make contact with her in most ways, because it's hard for them to kind of materialize. And one thing that she did notice when they were in this city is that they had specifically Pars had this kind of insignia on his chest, and it it was like an emblem, but it had a squiggly lines in it, triangles, circles, a bunch of different shapes going on it. It seemed kind of nonsensical in many ways, but you know, sometimes there's insignias, sometimes there isn't. But 2 months later, we get one of the most dramatic moments of this entire case. And it was dubbed in the book, The Exorcism. That's right. We've got an exorcism happening here. Not your typical exorcism, mind you. We're exorcising a sentient planet from coming into our own time and space, as you do.
Uh-huh. Just, I did that last week. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. It's like really taxing. Like it's really tough on the human body, but Gaynor kind of described how she was troubled by something, but she couldn't like kind of put her mind on it. And there was an evening, the evening of August 9th, and she started to go just like really pale. And she looked out the window and she thought she could see Arna briefly kind of trying to materialize, but she knew that something was wrong. She couldn't figure it out, though. And then a few days later, kind of like a week and a half later, on August 20th, this fear is just kind of mounted to a point. She realizes that there was something big that was going to come through to our dimension, a planet, a sentient planet. And Arna had shown her this kind of mental image of a planet that was coming through a doorway. And that's how Arna and Pars came through into Wales, is through this magical doorway. So Gaynor basically had to drive this planet back. So she gathers her family together out in the yard and they drive it back using quote unquote loving thoughts. Like, I'm not kidding you. That's pretty much how she says it. Loving thoughts. As you do. And
interesting.
Yes. And she claimed that this planet was frightened of adults. So it kind of has this like child's mindset in a way of in the way that she described it, because there's like a lot of feeling put to this, like this planet's not meaning to come through. It was just that's where it was headed and it was going to come through. It's kind of innocent, but she's like basically like it wasn't evil. It wasn't planned to destroy anything. It was just the course that it was on. Either way, she drives it back, crisis averted, through the power of love, we're driving a planet back. So I have a question, first and foremost. Does that sound like the plot to a movie to any of you? Because there's a specific movie that comes to mind when I think of this. I don't know if it does for you guys, but I thought of this instantly.
No.
It sounds like the plot to The Fifth Element. Like, literally.
Oh,
the end.
Oh.
So at the end of The Fifth Element, you know, the thing is like there's this invading sentient planet that's coming down and it's going to destroy basically Earth. I think it's Earth. But the main character in that story, who the heck is her? Who the heck is she? I can't even remember. God damn it. All right.
I just Googled it, so because I haven't seen this movie.
Mila Jovovich.
Yeah, Mila Jovovich. That's yeah. It. So yeah. She's kind of this being that appears out of nowhere and she's supposed to do something. So what they do is like they essentially take the four elements in this temple together with the fifth element, which is love. Love is the fifth element. And drives it away, drives this planet away, basically just kind of kills it. And this is basically the plot to The Fifth Element. Like before The Fifth Element came out, it was happening in real life, folks. It happened in real life. We know it. We have it. It's been documented.
Do you think they got that idea from this story then? Or
that's like, what I wonder. I wonder. Yeah.
Because I feel like that's just too specific of a something to, you know, of a story to just, I don't know, though.
Yeah.
Drive it back with love.
Yeah.
Of course, it was in the 70s, too.
right? Mm-hmm. It was the first and only time Thoughts and Prayers has ever worked.
The only time. It has averted a planet coming into this time and dimension and just ripping shit up.
Wow.
This was that moment. You are absolutely correct. Gaynor goes on like kind of a bunch of other expeditions and stuff to this planet with Arna and Pars. She goes to see this kind of like alien zoo, and the names for these animals are kind of nonsensical and where they come from and stuff like that. Definitely like something from the mind of a child in many ways. And she sees distinctly on one trip, glowing Bigfoot like creatures, like short Bigfoot like creatures with glowing yellow eyes.
Now. Oh, yes.
Yeah. There was one time they see it while she's playing with her sister Neris, who's the youngest Sunderland child. And they're like kind of playing in the yard, and they see this like short creature just kind of loping around, and it's like, oh yeah, I saw them on the planet with Arna and Pars. You know, it's no big deal. They're fine. So her brother Barry, after, you know, they start getting the attention from this case and stuff, he starts talking about an experience that he had, that he had seen a craft and beings in a field in 1976. Only the beings that he interacted with, they kind of looked like the Kelly Hopkinsville goblins in a lot of ways. They were They had long pointy ears, just very similar in the way that they looked. So that's kind of Barry just putting his foot into the whole mystery thing. And at a certain point, the activity kind of shifted to Darren, and Darren started to experience a lot of weird stuff. There's one visitation where he awoke and he kind of found himself surrounded by a bunch of light, and he was terrified, so he closes his eyes tight. He opens up again, and he's in this strange field, and there are those beings, the ones that are, you know, about to lose it with those guns and, you know, missing that hair, and they're kind of he's looking at them on each side. They're in this strange field, and there are familiar but kind of different looking beings on the other side, and he's looking at these two opposing groups, and they're at war with each other, basically. So these beings give Darren this model. It's a model of the George Jetson looking like craft, and they instruct him to take it and go over to the other people and give it to them. So he does. He starts walking over to this field. And this is like, you know, World War One type trench warfare stuff here. It seems like, you know, he's in the middle of no man's land. And, you know, he goes over and he presents this to these beings, and these beings fearfully told him to take it back, get it the hell away from them. And he describes it playing out as if it's a scene from Star Wars, which, you know, by this time is, popular and stuff. So after that, he's transported back into his bedroom again. And eventually these contacts die down for him, too. You know, he has the beings appear like his experiences feel in many ways more abduction-y like, as opposed to Gaynor's, which are more contactee-ish. So there's kind of that little bit of difference. But this is where the story evolves into psychic questing. Yes. Ooh. The psychic questing. And you may be asking yourself, what the hell is psychic questing? Well, I'm going to quote from a paper from a man named Simon Nugent. It's called Overlooked or Overcooked: The Case for Psychic Questing in Western Esotericism. Psychic questing activity can be extremely varied depending upon the nature of the quest being undertaken. However, there are three useful definitions, and they are as follows. One, using intuitively inspired thoughts and information for creative purposes, be it the exploration of history, the search for hidden artifacts, or simply the quest for enlightenment. cool. Two, the investigation of historical and sacred landscape mysteries via the combination of archival research and magical and psychical techniques. The similarity to this, the similarity of this to a pragmatic approach to magic, such as chaos or rune work, will become apparent quite quickly for both our concern with results. And three, a quest may begin in many ways, often with a psychic tuning in to a site and sensing a message. The information received could be a vision or communication with a site guardian figure, a thought form left behind from the past to watch over and spiritually care for the site. So, as the writer mentions in this paper, in the second definition, like basically it's using chaos magic to find things, historical things, historical artifacts, exploring historical places. Like it's pretty cool. It's a cool idea. And it arises through two figures in the late 1970s. And these two figures, the first is Andrew Collins. Now, people today would know Andrew Collins if they had watched Ancient Aliens, because he's the guy that talks endlessly about Göbekli Tepe. So he's that guy. Say what you will about Andrew Collins. The other's a man named Graham Phillips. And I don't really know that much about Graham. I didn't really find a whole heck of a lot of information on him. I didn't do a whole heck of a lot of digging because it's just this story. But the Sunderland family gets wrapped up in this. And this becomes a thing in, and there are still modern, I think, psychic questing groups and stuff like that. But this became a thing after this initial story takes place. So Graham and Andrew, they meet in 1978 and they start to collaborate on a magazine called Strange Phenomenon. They kind of share a flat in Liverpool, and this would lead them to start a paranormal research organization called Parasearch. Yeah.
Creative. Yeah. They figured it out. They got it. Great job, guys.
Nailed it. Got it in one. So, yeah, the Collins and Phillips, they share this flat. And it's also where they kind of made Strange Phenomenon. They sold it out of their flat and everything. So on Wednesday, October 17th, 1979, Collins arrives at home to an agitated Phillips pacing back and forth, going on about something trying to, quote unquote, get through. This is very Gaynor Sunderland-ish, so it fits in very well with what's going on here. So, you know, you got a friend, and what's your friend offering to do for you? To put you under hypnosis, you know, as friends do. Hey, man, I'll help you suss this out right here. Just lay back. I got it.
Okay.
Yeah. And this is a direct quote from Andrew Collins' website. Like, I'm going to be quoting a bunch from his website in this one piece that he wrote about the origins of psychic questing. Quote, after some discomfort, Graham relaxed, and I found myself speaking to a secondary personality named Joanna, inspired by a living person of this name named Joanna Wasson, an old friend of Graham's from his days in college in Exeter. This personality comes out. Meonia, the word Meonia, which is going to be kind of a key word for them, was offered by Joanna as a name for the Philosopher's Stone, the material substance sought by medieval alchemists to achieve a state of spiritual completion and perfection cloaked under the guise of the transmutation of base metal into gold. That's right. We're dealing with the Philosopher's Stone here today, folks. It's here. There is no question that the ancients saw the Emerald Tablet of Hermes as an expression of this stone, looked on as a vehicle that enabled the practitioner to achieve oneness with the Supreme Being, the Hermetic concept of the One. In this way, the statement, "I am one," encoded in the word Meonia, makes sense of its apparent connection, not only with the Philosopher's Stone, but with the Emerald Tablet itself. That's right. That is right.
Oh, I see. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow. All
We're right. We're just throwing names and anything we can at it.
Sounds legit. Sounds cool.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't know.
It sounds convincing. It does sound convincing.
Yeah, if you don't think too hard about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Seriously, you don't need to think too hard on it. It's just, it is what it is. So Andrew Collins' narrative on this is kind of very confusing, and I'm going to try and rein it in as much as I can. Andrew had spoken to a psychic earlier that day named Alan Beard, and Beard explained that 2 days earlier he had a vision of a green stone. The stone first began in his dream as a loaf of bread, and it shrunk down to the apparent size of an egg, before the image settled on an oval-shaped green stone, and it had been worn in a ring, quote, unquote, by an important woman. So this personality, Joanna, basically said that they had to find this green stone at all costs and gave them a location, Harvington Hall, which was the home of a guy named Sir Humphrey Packington. So he's connected with an event called the Gunpowder Plot of 1605, which was a failed assassination attempt on King James I in order to restore the Catholic monarchy in England. And it's believed that Packington took possession of the greenstone following the arrest of the conspirators in this plot. So, failed plot to overthrow the king. There's a greenstone. It's given to Packington, who lived at Harvington Hall. So, quote, this information led us to note potential clues among the remaining murals in a first floor corridor of the hall, which portrayed the nine worthies, nine great heroes of history, generally three biblical, three legendary, and three historical. They drew us to consider the importance of a distinctive sword stance displayed by at least two of the worthies, the strong man Samson and the giant slayer David. It's so great. God. Just so. It's so epic.
Most of the stuff I like don't even know how to react to, because I'm just like, what? Where are we now? I thought we were.
Yeah.
We were talking about like aliens and shit. What?
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, this is, you know, when the aliens go away, you've got to find other things to occupy your time. So it's like you're questing. Yes. Known as the St. George Parry, where the weapon is held horizontally above the head to block an attack, it persuaded us to research the possible relevance of knighthood, chivalry, and the saga of King Arthur to the Green Stone story. We even felt that the St. George's Parry might be a clue pointing towards the importance of the familiar image of King Arthur's sword Excalibur held in a horizontal position by the Lady of the Lake. Perhaps we were looking for a concealment place on an island in the middle of a lake somewhere in the landscape. So
that narrows it down.
Yep. Yeah. So
the Andrew landscape Graham, TM. You,
yeah.
Trademark.
Yeah. Yeah. So Andrew and Graham do a bit of research, and it leads them to this kind of isolated pool on the estate of the Earl of Coventry beneath a place called Knight's Hill. So you got some knights. It's kind of, you know, coming back into the fold symbolically here. And right before they investigate this, they get a phone call from their friend Alan Beard, whom they had not spoken to in a few days, and talked about this other vision that he had, indicating that they wouldn't find the stone, but they would find a sword.
Okay. All right. I guess that's almost as good.
Yeah. So the date was Monday, 23 October 1979. And that night, after some effort, Graham and I retrieved a short steel sword from behind an age-old dry stone wall, holding up the bank next to a small brick footbridge at one end of the pool. It was covered in ivy and protected by thick undergrowth, making it extremely difficult to access. I am pretty confident that it had been there for a very long time indeed. The sword was found in a small cavity behind the ninth stone, down and along from the bridge. Nine was a recurring number in the quest. It was hermetically sealed in a thick layer of brown green resin, which on removal revealed a pristine sword with an inscription along the blade that read Meonia for Mary.
Mm.
Yes. Yes.
Mm. That's whoa.
So we got this word again, Meonia. Basically, again, it means I am one, or something similar to that. The Mary implied in the inscription was assumed to be Mary, Queen of Scots, the Catholic monarch imprisoned by Queen Elizabeth after being accused of plotting against her. For the remainder of her troubled life, Mary Stuart was frequently moved between castles in the north and Midlands of England until finally she reached where is that? Fotheringhay? I'm not sure how to pronounce that. In Northants, where she was executed in 1587. Joanna had claimed that Mary possessed the Meonia Stone. So now they're calling it the Meonia Stone. This green stone, the Meonia Stone, same thing. And she was wearing it on a ring before passing it on to a young Robert Catesby, the leader of the gunpowder plot. Now it's starting to tie in a little. But you know what? It doesn't fully, because that would be too easy.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. So apparently he had been taken to see her with his father, Sir William Catesby, himself a recusant when she was imprisoned in a castle in the neighboring county of Staffordshire just 2 years before his execution. So these are folks that are basically they refused to kind of convert to Protestantism, which was the big which was pretty heavy around that time in 1605 and stuff. That's really what it has to do, is like England is largely Protestant. Catholics aren't happy about it. So, you know, Catholics try to plot and do a really bad job of it. You know, it happens. So she in turn hands this ring off to Humphrey here, Humphrey Packington, at Harvington Hall. You know, he wasn't implicated in the plot, but he was among the ranks that he was among those Catholic ranks, man. He wasn't going to convert. So he took it upon himself to be the stone's guardian. So Joanna now has predicted for them the quest for the Green Stone would be completed by Halloween. And this is where the Sunderlands enter the story. This is another direct quote from Alan's website. We had forgotten that Alan had said the sword would be used as an indicator to find the stone. And so during the mid-evening, about to spend the night at a hotel in the Cotswolds town of Moreton-on-the-Marsh, we were convinced by a friend, Marion Sunderland, mother of Gaynor, a high-profile UFO contactee featured in the book Alien Contact by Jenny Randalls, that we should return as soon as possible to the Knights Hill Pool, where they would help us find the elusive stone. So Sunderland's now involved, friends with Alan Collins and such. So this is what happened the next day, Monday, 29 October. Standing on the footbridge next to where the sword was found, Gaynor used the ceremonial weapon, found to be late 19th century manufacture, as a divining instrument, rotating it clockwise until she felt drawn to a particular direction. Here, she said, some 2 miles away was a ruined building, an abbey perhaps, which held an important clue to the quest. So Gaynor is full on, you know, she's full on into divination now, you know, just able to, you know, do that. Don't know where that came from, but
that's great.
Yeah.
Good for her.
Yeah. So sure enough, there was a ruin exactly where she had indicated. It was located at a place called Dunstan Common. Yet it turned out not to be an abbey, but a sham castle built in the 18th century by the landscape architect. And this dude has the best name ever, Capability Brown.
That's very good. What a capable boy.
Yeah. It was built as part of the estate of the Earl of Coventry. So this folly bore impressive square and round towers, one of which was accessible, enabling Graham, Gaynor, and I to climb its spiral staircase. We trod carefully in the partial darkness, but then became concerned by the sound of beating wings above us. It was accompanied by the fall of loose debris, which cascaded down onto our heads. Assuming that a large bird blocked our path, we turned back and headed out of the mysterious tower. It was probably pigeons. It was probably nesting pigeons. But yeah, like there is some like odd stuff in that, you know, that's like you're climbing up a tower and you think like a large bird is going to like. What? A large bird? What large birds in England, sir? What large birds?
Like maybe an they owl? Were... Like...
Okay. It
depends on how big they are. I don't know.
We maybe came they all were this like... way, and we're just, like, afraid of an owl. So we're gonna go. We're gonna turn around now. I'm all set, actually.
Yeah.
Were they distracted by the fact that they were in a quote-unquote castle, and maybe they're like, ah, dragon!
Right, there's like a lot of aesthetic to the story. Like this feels like a King Arthur story in a lot of ways.
I love it.
Yeah, it's just so fantastic. That night at Marion and Gaynor's home in Flint, North Wales, a small group gathered around an OS map of the Worcestershire landscape, looking for further clues to the quest, feeling like our luck was finally running out. Fred Sunderland, Marion's husband, narrowed down the search by ringing an area that included those sites already marked out as important, perhaps. It was here, he suggested, that we should concentrate our efforts to find a location. About to give up, Marion flicked through a book on Queen Mary of Scots and noticed how the Catholic monarch embroidered pictures of waterfowl, she said swans, with their necks in a distinctive U-shape. Marion mentioned this out loud, at which Graham's eyes fell upon a bend on the River Avon called the Swan's Neck, located firmly within our designated search area. Stabbing the map, he exclaimed that he had found it and now felt sick inside. We all looked and saw the Swan's Neck marked. It was important not simply because of the tangential link with Mary, Queen of Scots, but because in 1600, a new star, actually a supernova, had been sighted in the constellation Cygnus, the celestial swan, which was seen by continental Rosicrucian mystics as a sign of a coming age of enlightenment, a fact which seems strangely relevant to our quest.
Yes.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, okay. Long story short, they come to believe that the swan is a symbol of hope for suppressed Catholics under Mary, Queen of Scots, as well as Protestant Rosicrucians. They both kind of like use this symbol. The Rosicrucians, you know, they're a little more metal than the Catholics. They practice like magical philosophy based on Hermetic teachings, you know, like a little like cooler in a lot of ways. So. The next day, Graham leaves early. He decides he wants to go research the Swan's Neck thing. And while he's out, Marion calls and says Gaynor experienced a powerful dream the night before. Gaynor described her dream. Graham, Alan, and Gaynor were ascending a tower at Dunstall Castle. So this is, they're back there again. They heard the sound of beating wings above them, but instead of running away, they continued to ascend and met a huge swan with its wings outstretched, and around its neck was a pouch held in place by cord. Gaynor was convinced that the green stone was inside. The swan led them to a location where there was running water and stated that this is where they would find it. Hours later, Graham calls and asks to meet at the Knight's Hill pool. And they get out there and they notice that somebody's been digging. He's got some dirt on his hands. He's been doing something. So, you know, Alan clues him into Gaynor's dream and they make a kind of a new approach. They come from a different angle. They go through this kind of field meadow. And they notice where that takes them. There's some evidence of digging. It's a little bit of digging. He's been digging a little bit. And, you know, everyone is a little startled. But, and like the narrative this entire time is that Graham and Alan have these enemies, their adversaries that are on their tail at all times that are going to find this stone. Like it, this epic thing, like it's almost too epic for its own good. But Alan Beard reassures them that the stone will come to them regardless. So Graham insists that they go to the Sunderland's house to reconvene. So at this point, Alan is just completely suspicious, as he should be, that Graham's found it. He's already found it. So they go to the Sunderland's house, and Graham goes and meets with Gaynor for a period of time by themselves. And he presents her this, what they call a brass casket. And inside this casket is the green gem. So Graham found it. And he had, you know, concerns that a large group of people going through this field meadow, it would draw attention to it. And people would be like, hey, what are you doing? Don't dig in this area, blah, 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 all that stuff. But it's not very deep. He said that it was like, you know, kind of like less than 6 inches or so in the ground. This wasn't a big kind of box that it was in, but when he opened it, the green stone was in another silver, smaller silver box. And there was this black stone that was sitting next to it. And he gets this feeling like, don't touch the black stone, man. Don't touch it. And he takes it and he hucks it into the river. And he takes the silver box, takes the stone out of it, and reburies the silver box. Now, paranoia kicks in. And, you know, Graham puts the silver box back in the ground, doesn't, you know, he wants to throw his adversaries off and everything. So, funnily enough, Alan went back up to the site to dig in the area where he said he buried it. Couldn't find the silver box. So, but the thing is like, Alan's not like, oh, he lied about this. He's like, oh no, our adversaries are hot on our tail. They must have dug it up and stuff. But like, adversaries, what are you talking about, man? Just
who?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it that owl that was in that tower?
It was that owl.
God dang it. The owls again. It's always the owls.
It's always, always the owls. Following the completion of the quest, both the stone and casket were given into the care of Marion Sunderland, who championed the Greenstone story throughout her life. Sadly, following her death in 2005, her daughter Gaynor inherited the item and sold it to an unknown bidder. Their whereabouts is unknown, according to Alan, but according to I just stumbled upon a Twitter post from somebody. I'm not going to name who this person is, but I mean, if you search on Twitter, you can find it. This individual claimed that Gaynor Sunderland was his stepmother for a period of time, that he had seen a green stone, and he said that it looked like a piece of costume jewelry.
Oh.
So, yeah, that's... that's kind of where that ends, but like the psychic questing stuff was a huge thing in England in the 80s and the 90s. It kind of died down a lot in the 90s, but again, there are still kind of like psychic questing groups that still do it to this day. Go out, look for, you know, things, whatever purpose you have in it. But psychic questing, it's interesting, but there are a lot of criticisms that were levied against the Sunderland family, primarily by Jenny Randles, who wrote the book, who didn't really as much investigate the cases as did like basically write the book. She did have a little bit of contact with the family, but one thing that she always said was that Gaynor Sunderland and Marion Sunderland, they were kind of like these attention hounds. They were always in the middle of it, always wanting the attention. So she took that to mean, you know, like that they were making up a lot of this stuff, you know, kids wanted to get in on this. And the thing is like Jenny Randles wrote this dissent in an issue of the Befora Journal, in which she was writing a book, a review for a book. And that book is Eye of the Fire by Graham Phillips and another guy named Martin Keatman. And she basically took the opportunity because of her connections with the psychic questing stuff, because this is a book all about psychic questing, and just like rips into the Sunderland family, like, you know, out of nowhere. And eventually Marion Sunderland kind of, writes her own rebuttal that's printed in the Befora Journal. They kind of have this little go, you know, back and forth. But yeah, like Jenny Randles didn't totally believe it. And I mean, that's also kind of Jenny Randles. She's kind of one of like a skeptical believers is the best way that I would describe her. Also, like the first, trans woman in, you know, UFO research and stuff, so she's a badass all the way. But yeah, okay, just she wasn't totally on board with it, and I understand, because it's a story that is weird. So at the end of this, where are you all on this story right here now?
I am really with them for, yeah, the first part. I'm really with them. And then, I don't know, the psychic questing just feels like a publicity stunt. Mm-hmm. Like they made that whole story up, you know, and then they got a piece of costume jewelry to be like, we got the thing, but no one else can see it.
Right.
But yeah,
my thought was actually quite different. I mean, I obviously, the first part, I'm with them. The psychic questing thing, I was with them up to a certain point. And the only reason why is because I have done and experienced things like that. Mm-hmm. And what this immediately reminds me of is Hellier. Yeah. You know, that's my first thought, is Hellier. And how they're, you know, taking all this evidence and tracking it and following clues and everything like that and using magic, you know, alongside it. So from that perspective, it makes sense to me. And it seems like it's something that could be real. But the costume jewelry thing, I think, really threw me off. The fact that he went out and did all this digging and found the thing by himself and then, you know, made up some excuse as to why it had to just be him that found it. That is where I get, you know, I almost... And especially with what you just said about Marion and her daughter, you know, my first thought is almost like, were they using this as a way to like make money? you know, were they trying to say this thing is super valuable, even though it's just a piece of costume jewelry, so that they could sell it and get the money for it? Like, I don't know. But
And the thing is like, I don't think they really profited off their story at all. Like, that's that's the one thing that that they didn't have, is just like making money off the story, because I mean, they didn't write the book, they never wrote the articles. The only thing that they ever wrote was, you know, Marion Sunderland's descent of what Jenny Randall's had written. So, like, I don't think they made a lot of money. And, like, I don't even know if they ended up selling it. You know, they were saying, yeah, it was sold to somebody. Some people said, oh, it wasn't really sold. They held on to it. And, like, nobody's really sure what had happened to it. But again, I don't know today if it would really be worth, even in 2005 when Marion Sunderland died, I don't even know if it would have been worth anything, you know, just given like the reputation that Psychic Questing had by that point. Because these are kind of like the two relic items, the sword and this this green stone. And other than that, they didn't really make money off this. So I don't know. I don't know if it's just like publicity for publicity's sake, because some people, you know, can be like that. But at the same time, like, I think the one thing that gives me pause is the fact that their story appeared in the paper and nobody knows how it got there. Nobody knows who printed it. Nobody knows how it appeared there. So That's the one thing that gives me pause. But other than that, yeah, it's just a fantastic story, like from top to bottom. Except please do not hypnotically regress your children. Never do it.
No.
Just never do it. And please do not work with antiquated ray guns that shoot out slowly. It's not good. You know that thing is going to malfunction at some point, and you know, you've got to call up somebody and they're going to tell you, oh, well, did you turn it off and then turn it back on again? and it's a whole thing. Like, nobody wants to deal with that. So
nobody wants to deal with that.
Yeah. So those are the two things that you need to take away from this episode. Don't hypnotically regress your children. Stop working with antiquated ray guns. Just don't do it.
All right.
Yeah.
All
right, so, you know, with those messages imparted, thank you both so much for coming on for this episode. Cause this was just so much fun. And I know, Your Brain on Weird is on a little bit of a hiatus right now, but where can people keep up with what y'all are doing and you know, updates about when you may be coming back?
So we're on Twitter at @weird_pod. We do try to post updates mostly there. We don't really post anywhere else, so you can find us there. We also have a website, yourbrainonweird.com. We try to keep our updates there. But we are going to be releasing a new episode in October. We're going to kind of tag team the Salem Witch Trials. So we've got some stuff coming up.
Yeah. Awesome. Excellent. Yeah. And as for us at the Our Strange Skies podcast, if you want to keep up with us, you know, follow along, all that good stuff, OurStrangeSkies.com has all the links that you need for anything you want to do. You want to buy some dope merch? Go get it. There's a link there for it. Patreon. Go get it. It's there.
Get you some.
Put that sweet, sweet merch on your body. It's great. It's fantastic.
You deserve it.
Treat yourself. Special thanks to Floats for the use of their song UFO as the theme for this podcast. To Spencerworth Davis, who is the man behind the scenes, Megan Lagerberg for the logo, and the great Desdemona for our t-shirt designs. And finally, don't forget to look up, because you never know what you'll find in our strange skies or in your dreams when you're psychic questing. In gray, we trust.